America is now a place where if you work hard, get educated, and an honest person, you can succeed. That's what should be put out there.
As Americans, we have long believed that our country was built on the truth in that statement uttered by conservative commentator Bill O'Reilly, that hard work and personal character are all you need to achieve the American dream.
Now, using a quarter century of data, researchers from the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis have written a series of controversial, one could even say provocative, essays that indicate the personal wealth envisioned in that statement is really only possible for a few, and that age, race, and education all play key roles in who is selected.
Hello, I'm Steve Berger along with Samantha Horton, and this is the Demographics of Wealth. Over the next few months, with the help of John Gibson and Paola Marisan, we're taking an in-depth look at the factors that affect your ability to thrive financially in America.
Our goal is to present the findings of the Fed's essays in direct, simple terms, using examples that apply to our region. A few of the findings will confirm suspicions long held in some communities that it's tougher to get ahead financially than perhaps it should be. Others will smash long-held stereotypes about certain demographic groups.
Our hope is that by shining a light into some dark corners of our collective experience, we can prompt discussion that leads to solutions that are demographically and ethnically sound. Because as you'll see in these programs, the American dream is not one dream, but many.
So let's get started. We didn't have to go far to find an example to illustrate the relationship of the factors affecting financial wealth in America. We found it right in our own backyard when we visited the O.Z. Tyler Distillery in Owensboro. So how does the process of distilling, distributing, and marketing top-shelf bourbon relate to the American dream? Let's take, for example, race and ethnicity. While bourbon can be made anywhere in the United States, the prized title being labeled Kentucky Bourbon is reserved only for companies producing it in the state of Kentucky. Earl Hewlett, CEO of TerraCentia, which owns this facility, explained why his company is moving their bourbon production from South Carolina to Owensboro.
Well, technically, under our federal regulations, bourbon can be made anywhere. A lot of people think the only place bourbon can be made is Kentucky. And I would say that particularly overseas, they want Kentucky bourbon. All the reasons that bourbon began here still exist. Seasonality, availability of barrels, wood, good water, and proximity to corn and other grains. So.
For bourbon, location is the constant if you want to get the highest price. After all, you can't move Kentucky someplace else and produce bourbon. For personal wealth in America, according to the essays at least, one unchangeable factor is race and ethnicity. At a public forum held in Owensboro earlier this year, Owensboro Human Relations Commission Executive Director Sylvia Coleman noted the connection between race and wealth outlined in the Fed's essays.
When you look at blacks and Hispanics, even when blacks have more college education than Hispanics, Hispanics still earn more. Not a whole lot more, but more is more. They still earn more than blacks. It's a bit depressing, but it is our reality.
St. Louis Fed researcher Dr. William Emmons takes it one step further, dredging up ugly racial images that many Americans thought we had long put behind us.
Part of the explanation for why young families seem to be slipping could be that they are more racially and ethnically diverse as a group than ever before. And we know that race and ethnicity-based disadvantages continue to loom large in our society.
But some change is happening. We see national leaders today unable to reach a consensus on solutions that are ethnically diverse. However, Mexican immigrant Ofelia Villegas, who has only an elementary school education, had no trouble defining the issue for them.
Las cosas que he escuchado, yo creo que son cotidianas y son muy normales las preguntas. To me, these situations are very normal. The only thing I did find surprising was that the news is interested in this because we need information, a lot of information, because minorities are becoming majorities. I think things can change because, for example, I'm Mexican and I just went to elementary school, and when I arrived to this country, I told my kids, you can be anything you want to be in this country. I didn't want them to be like me. I wanted them to be more than me.
What about education? It turns out that the quality is a key factor for both the ingredients in a good batch of bourbon, as well as for an education that generates wealth. The essays from the St. Louis researchers show that a good education still adds to your wealth over the course of your lifetime. Owensboro attorney Susan Montalvo-Gesser, however, spoke for a generation saddled with student debt that threatens to drastically alter the Fed's data in future years.
I did win the education lottery, but at a high cost. I have student loans until I'm 62, and that's not uncommon for people who didn't come from means that do attain a higher level of education, and that affects our wealth over the term of our life, that we have almost what looks like a mortgage payment every month until we pay off those student loans.
As barrels roll off the truck at Ozzie Tyler's warehouse to start the aging process, it's because bourbon brings a higher price with age. And because with temperature and rain variation, some production years are better than others. Likewise, Emmons with the St. Louis Fed draws a direct connection between when you were born and your financial wealth.
So there seems to be a birth lottery, and the people born around 1940 hit the jackpot. People after that had somewhat less success, and it reached its trough in the 1970s. So if you're a Generation Xer, you lost.
We've had a little fun using the bourbon example to demonstrate how race, age, and education can all affect your ability to thrive financially in America. But there's another aspect to the analogy that's a little more disturbing. When you go to purchase a bottle of bourbon, you can't help but notice the various brands are grouped together based on their value. The nicer bottles are found on the higher shelf, and the lower quality located on the bottom shelves. Separated, placed into their own form of a caste system. The Demographics of Wealth essays uncover that America has its own way of deciding who gets a spot on the top shelf. There's not a lot of happy news in the demographics of wealth. But there is hope. The St. Louis Fed researchers who compiled the data and wrote the essays say they did it so local leaders and organizations can have the data they need to start the discussions that can lead to a positive change. I'm Samantha Horton.
Now that you have an idea of the three limiting demographic factors we'll use in our series, there are a couple of important notes to make about this data so you know why it provides such a good starting point for meaningful discussion on these issues.
First, the data used for the essays authored by researchers for the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis comes from the national survey conducted by the Federal Reserve every 3 years. It's called the Survey of Consumer Finances. It provides a comprehensive view of American family balance sheets and their financial behavior over time.
The survey was launched in 1989 and conducted every 3 years, as we said, following that, creating a total of 9 data sets with information on over 40,000 families. The surveys used in the Demographics of Wealth essays are from 1989 to 2013. Here's the limitation. The data used in the essays, especially in the educational essay, is from families where the head of household is an average of 40 years old. Now, their reasoning is that households in that range are fairly stable, and they are then inclusive of everyone, regardless of sexual preference. Now, we'll see in later programs that the researchers ended up revising their findings to include factors like the effects of the recent recession and the crushing load of student loan debt present in increasing numbers of households.
The St. Louis Fed researchers were able to determine that thriving households are more likely to be middle-aged or older, white or Asian, and with a college degree or graduate one. Those households make up a quarter of the population, but they have two-thirds of the wealth. Conversely, struggling households were more likely to be younger, less educated, and Black or Hispanic. These strugglers make up three-fourths of the population and have only about one-third of the wealth.
Dr. William Emmons, a senior economic advisor at the Center for Household Financial Stability, explained the results to a group in Owensboro in May of this year.
We have enough data that we can try to hold some things constant and identify one thing at a time and see which factor seems to be associated, say, with accumulating wealth. The results are generally the same, but there's some subtle differences. As we talked about with that financial health score, holding everything else constant, people get richer as they get older. Okay, maybe that's not too surprising. Not everybody. Right. Okay, then in terms of when you were born, looking at from the beginning of the 20th century forward, the later you were born, up until 1940, the richer you are, holding everything else constant, your age, your race, your education, etc. So there seems to be a birth lottery, and the people born around 1940 hit the jackpot. People after that had somewhat less success, and it reached its trough in the 1970s. So if you're a Generation Xer, you lost. And a lot of that, of course, is the housing market. That's not to say that a lot of families won't recover, but you were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the crash of the housing market hit those people the hardest. And then there looks like there's been some recovery since then. As for education, you may think this is too stark. This suggests it's not. Families without college degrees basically have not accumulated wealth. There are exceptions. But for groups, wealth accumulation appears to be exclusively a college graduate phenomenon. I don't think that that's a law of nature. I think it can change, but partly because of the risky balance sheets, partly because of the hand you're dealt in various dimensions, for example, in the job market. That's the reality. And as for race and ethnicity, and again, these are holding everything else constant. In this case, holding constant your education, that is comparing college versus college, high school versus high school across race groups, holding constant when you were born, so only comparing people born at the same time, all of those things, whites have significantly more wealth than Asian families, who in turn have significantly more wealth than Black and Hispanic families. Holding constant education and all those other factors, which could be one of the legacies, the historical legacies. Because inheritance is one of the ways wealth is transmitted, there's lots of evidence that especially Black families have not benefited from inheritance, and that goes back throughout our history.
I followed up with Emmons and fellow researcher Brian Noweth to further discuss the essays. As previously mentioned, both of you are authors of the Demographics of Wealth essays. So what inspired the creation of these essays?
Well, I think we started our work about 3 years ago, really recognizing that the severe recession had affected families differently. Some have recovered better than others. And so our work is really inspired by that ultimate goal of trying to understand which families have done better in bouncing back from the recession and which have done worse, and what the what some of the reasons for that might be.
One of the more striking statistics in the essays was that an African American that has a college degree still has less wealth than what a Caucasian without a high school diploma has. Historically speaking, why does this occur, and can you say if there is any indication of this changing?
The relationship between wealth of different racial and ethnic groups, as well as the relative incomes, seems to be very slow to change. In the work that we've done, looking at about the last quarter century, although there was some narrowing of the gaps between the typical white family and the typical black or Hispanic family, the net result, after some improvement, then there was deterioration during the recession, means there hasn't been much change. And it's something on the order of about 10 or 11 times higher for the typical, that is, the median white family compared to the median Hispanic and black family. And we really can't say for sure why that is. What we have documented is that the changes are quite persistent, and it doesn't really change the story if we look at different age groups or different education levels, although there is a little bit smaller gap between families with college educations, looking within or across these different groups.
Continuing on, while demographics and financial health are covered in the essays, one criticism has been that the study doesn't directly speak about household spending behavior. Do you believe this could change some of the conclusions that have been made from your essays?
Well, certainly how people earn their income, how they spend it, how they save it, all of these things matter. So yes, I think differences in spending certainly would be part of the explanation. The data set we're using for most of this work is the Survey of Consumer Finances. It's created by the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, and it doesn't have a lot of information about spending. There are other data sources that we might well take some time and look into this more in the future, but at this point, what we wanted to do was document really more of the financial aspects of people's lives. And so you're right that we haven't looked at different spending behaviors.
I will say, though, in our financial health scorecard that we have in there, we do have kind of a crude savings rate, just asking, did you spend less than you earned last year? So that is, at some level, is a proxy for consumption. But,
right,
but,
yeah, yeah.
But it's not perfect.
Until the final essay, there was not much mentioned about those under the age of 40, with the belief that they are still making large financial purchases and have not had the chance to fully pay back all the debt they've accumulated. So what made you decide to discuss those under the age of 40 in the final essay?
Well, we've always been interested in the full range, from people in their 20s up through the end of life. In the first of our three essays that looked specifically at race and ethnicity, we did include young people, but we didn't stress that dimension very much. And in fact, I guess, as I mentioned just a moment ago, we thought perhaps differences in the age, you know, how many people were of certain ages of different groups might be one of the explanations for these big gaps, because we know older people tend to have more savings and wealth, for example. In fact, we found that didn't make much difference, the fact that, for example, Hispanics on average are younger than whites. So age was, or young people were in that first essay, just were not a primary focus. You're right, in our second essay, we did focus on people 40 years or older. And the main reason for doing that was to be as certain as we could be that we were observing people with their completed education. We wanted to not have the situation of looking at, say, someone in their 20s who maybe had low income and low wealth, who subsequently might get more education and have quite a bit higher income and wealth later in life. And so because we were interested in how each family, for example, was choosing how much to borrow, what kinds of assets to acquire, how much in the terms of cash reserves to keep on hand, we wanted to exclude those cases that I just outlined, someone who looks like they're going to be low income and wealth, but it's only a temporary thing. And so we did exclude the people under 40. And then finally, as you say, in our third essay, we're specifically looking at young people. The way we looked at it in two dimensions. One was when you were born, how important that was. And the second was where you are in your life course or in your life cycle. So obviously, we knew that people who are young are facing lots of different challenges and opportunities than people who are older. So we wanted to really look at different stages of life carefully.
After completing your research and publishing its findings, how do you wish national, state, and local governments would use the information the essays provide?
Well, we can't make any specific policy recommendations, but as I said, I think often, I mean, and we hear this from policymakers and their staff, that often there isn't enough information, or at least not enough objective information, where there's no vested interest, we're not selling anything, and it's sometimes not framed in a way that's useful. And so our hope is that we can provide the inputs, the information for policymakers. That would be great if they can use some of this information, but it's also, of course, for private individuals. And that, I think, is the important thing, is to have informed citizens who can work with their representatives to come up with ways to help really the groups that we've been focusing on as being particularly economically vulnerable: younger people, people with less education, people from historically disadvantaged backgrounds, racial and ethnic groups, especially African Americans and Hispanics, to be able to use this information to talk about the risks and of various financial decisions, and hopefully tailor consumer protections and public policies in ways that will give everyone a better shot at building financial stability.
To conclude, this study has clarified some of the things that are impacting our economy and the people. Do you have any plans to conduct a future study and will it be similar to this one?
Yes, we hope to continue looking at both these demographic aspects of how families are doing in the recovering economy. We'd like to dig in especially to some of the intersections between these different dimensions. And we have a report coming out this week, for example, that looks at the connections between race and ethnicity on the one hand and education, and how that seems to have played out in recent years for wealth building. But we will, and of course, also be very much following the discussion, the issues that interested people in government and business and more broadly need to know. And so that also will guide the kinds of topics that we will be looking at.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, our journey to discover the demographics of wealth travels from the academic to the real world, when we drill down to the effects on our region and get reaction from people on the findings contained in the Fed's essays. While the essays from the St. Louis Fed researchers enlighten us about national trends, we couldn't get them to break it down for this region. For that, we turn to Dr. Mohammed Kayyum, Dean of the School of Business at the University of Southern Indiana.
To start off, the annual income data from the American Community Survey, which the Census Bureau last published in 2013, shows that Evansville has approximately 30% of its population making less than $22,000 a year. What does that mean in comparison to the national 20% roughly making that same amount?
Well, it does mean that we have a considerable number of individuals and households that have to cope with circumstances that for most people would be troubling because they're financially in a fragile situation. Therefore, it creates a lot of anxieties, difficulties projecting what the future would be like. And as a result of that, maybe make decisions that might not always be in their best interest for the long term.
Is this 30% of the population who makes less than $22,000 a year considered a high percentage?
Well, it is high by comparison to the national average. And it is something that contrasts very much with what people would want to happen in terms of the reality that they'd like to see around them. So if you asked individuals what would be the kind of distribution of income or wealth that they would see as ideal for any community or society, for the segment we're thinking of, most times it's not as high as that percentage in people's mind.
How does this 30% in the lower income group impact Evansville as a whole?
I think it creates a number of challenges for the individuals who are in those circumstances. It also creates potential problems for us in terms of coping with it in a long-term sense, of creating opportunities and possibilities for people to be mobile in the distribution of income. And it also challenges us to be a bit more creative in the ways in which we want to tackle that particular problem.
So can the size of a city be a factor in causing the increase or the decrease of a family's income?
Definitely. I think there are some benefits to having concentrations of people in terms of buying power, in terms of attraction to businesses based on the sheer volume of individuals. And the networks that arise because of the interaction of individuals also create benefits that do not accrue to places where there are sparse populations.
What solutions would you recommend to lower this low income percentage?
It is a challenge. Most times, there's not one answer. For many of these individuals, as we know in the national studies, there are some relationships between your position in the distribution of income and your level of educational attainment, as well as your age. Typically, when we're young, we don't have the ability to accumulate assets. And as we progress and obtain positions of employment, we're able to save. And then over time, we then use up those savings in the cycle of our lives. If we have the kinds of educational backgrounds that we would normally expect, for example, high school diploma, college degrees, graduate credentials, then you find that cycle that I just described to work well. Where in the early years of your life, you're accumulating that level of what we call human capital that then yields the benefits later on. So for many of the individuals in the lower bracket or the lower quintile or the lowest quintile, we have to pay attention to what their ages are, what their educational levels are, and then configure the kinds of steps that would make sense for those particular circumstances. For some of those individuals, it's opportunity for employment. For some, it's the kinds of opportunities that would allow them to progress to the educational levels that they need. And for some, it's us being much more innovative about how we induce them to change patterns of behavior with regard to financial decision-making, savings habits, spending habits, the ability to wait longer for satisfaction, to defer that gratification. All of those are variables that need attention, and as a result, it's difficult to craft one policy that would meet the needs of all those individuals.
In the Demographics of Wealth essays, it was brought to light that there is a clear financial wealth inequality amongst families of different races and ethnicities. Can this also be seen in Evansville, and how so?
Well, I think it's less possible to transfer their findings to Evansville because our demographic composition doesn't mirror the nation. African Americans, for instance, are in the city proper just over 12%. If we take the county, Vandenberg County, then it's just under 10%. And if you think of a regional metropolitan area, it's just, again, under 10%. So when we look at the study, there are some associations between the wealth positions of households and families and race. But I think that is a very simplistic approach towards finding a solution. I think understanding the nature of a problem is an important part of finding a solution. And so if we do just look at that demographic indicator and do not try to go beyond that to the more important influences on behavior, such as an individual's horizon in terms of short-term versus long-term, or willingness to take risk, and ways in which current circumstances can influence those attitudes and perceptions. So unless we pay attention to those specifics, even as we know race might have a strong immediate presence in terms of association between who's in the lowest quintile with regard to income and wealth and their race, which we do have indications that in Evansville, for instance, a proportion of our African-American households and Hispanics would be disproportionately in that group. But we also have a significant portion of white Americans who are in that particular income group as well. And so it does take more than just looking at the demographic indicator to find solutions that would be sustainable and progressively allow the city to become what we'd like it to be.
So in conclusion, what other things would you say we need to look into further when examining the lower portion other than their race and education?
Well, I think the study that did point out that these demographic factors such as age and educational attainment and race are important considerations, that study could be further developed to identify attributes of those heads of households with regard to some of the factors I mentioned earlier, their patience level, meaning how willing are they to defer immediate satisfaction, their horizons, how much into the future they look. And as a result of knowing those things, there are some ways in which financial planning and financial education programs can be customized to cater to our knowledge of those particular factors. So there are studies, for instance, that show that there are individuals in communities who find it difficult to save. And if we create educational programs, for instance, or opportunities for them to learn more about the habits of saving, we find that there's limited success because they have a tendency to want to consume whatever additional incomes they receive. However, studies have shown that with those same individuals, if you change the focus from their individual benefit from an activity to the benefits that accrue to, let's say, somebody who's close to them, with the same interventions, they respond differently. So individuals who show that they weren't willing to change their spending patterns for themselves, when given circumstances in which by doing so it would benefit others who they cared about, they changed. I think that's a good illustration of the ways in which we'd have to approach designing the kinds of awareness building activities and opportunities so that people have a way in which they could alter financial decision-making behavior that can be ultimately to their advantage.
To take this series on the demographics of wealth from the academic realm into reality, we got the views from some local folks on the essays.
Right. I don't know why, but just a few days ago that they were talking about that they have a study shown that during the downtime, you know, Asian people and white people, family, they do a bit better than black people and Latino people. And I don't know why, even though those people, they have the same education background. Say they all have PhD or they all have master degree. And supposedly, you know, they had to be fair in the same boat, right? Yes, you know, fair is, you know, similar, right? But and it's not the case here in the country. So I don't know if there's, it's in a big spender here and there, but you know, you can find out any ethnic background, right? And the safer, and you know, you can find out any background too. So I just don't know why.
It's disturbing to know that, like, statistically, the younger generation will make less money, but I think it really just comes down to you just have to take what you get and work hard and push through, because at this point, there's little you can do about the fact that you're going to make less money than previous generations because of all the statistics and the variables that there are in play. So you can really just do the best you can do and set yourself up for the best possibilities you can, which is going to be hard because there are a lot of people in our generation going for a lot of jobs. And as you know, we have a hurt job market right now. So there are going to be some people that aren't going to make it very well. The most interesting part of the study for me was the first part where they talked about how race influences, not necessarily influences income, but they showed statistics of how, you know, race median wealth happens. And it was interesting that the Asian community is actually rising higher up towards the Caucasian community now for wealth, and that'll kind of stay that ever at range.
Pues sí, causa sorpresa, impresión, porque poco se habla.
This study causes surprise because we speak little of this. In another state, there may be organizations dedicated to this type of study, but I had not heard of all this here. Knowing about these situations makes me think that we don't really know where to go or who to ask for help when we encounter circumstances like underpaid people, undocumented or not, and regardless of their race. I hadn't heard of it until now, and I think it's good to hear it and see that this conversation is starting to take place.
That was Newburgh resident named Sai, followed by Damian Burge and Enrique Nochebuena. One of the most interesting remarks about the financial strugglers in our society came from Brandon Harley, who is the Service Regional Administrator Associate for the Kentucky Division of Protection and Permanency. Harley talked about the resilience of the people who he sees in his work on a daily basis.
And looking at this and reading the essay over time over the last few nights and thinking about some of these things, you know, it's astounding to me that, frankly, that we have folks who might be in these situations that are able to still maintain and manage their day-to-day functioning with their families. That's the most amazing piece to me, is the strength and resolve of the folks that don't have the wealth or the income or the necessities really to make these day-to-day easy life decisions I think oftentimes we take for granted, and they still participate in the community. They still have kids in schools. They still are trying to go out and get jobs. They're still trying and maintaining households. And that's the biggest piece to me, that although they face large obstacles and struggles, they still maintain. And there are strengths to be seen from that. And I think that's a great place to start with where we move forward.
It is those reactions of area residents that prompted us to make our look at the demographics of wealth more than just one program. There are many more layers to peel back in order to have the information we need to start discussions that can lead to positive change. Let's take a short break. When we come back, a roundtable discussion among the producers of this program and what you can expect in the rest of our WNIN series on the demographics of wealth. We have more information at WNIN.org, including the Financial Health Scorecard in English and Spanish, so you can see how you measure up and become part of our research into the financial health of the tri-state. We're joined now by Paola Marisan to spend a few minutes on what we found so far.
So I guess we all have been looking at the study overall and been following it and what it's been showing. And I guess for me, the really interesting thing was how an African American with a college education cannot obtain the same financial wealth that a white person with less than a high school diploma essentially is able to obtain. And that was something that really has stood out to me, as there's something clearly wrong in the system if that was such a large difference in education levels. And I don't know what you guys found interesting out of the study yourselves.
Well, the thing that's most interesting to me about these studies and these essays is we've been talking about this issue for years, or these issues for years. People, you get all sorts of opinions on both sides, but nothing is based on facts. Finally, we have hard data that has been gone through by expert researchers that says you cannot dispute these things that we are saying. It's right there in black and white. And that's what's so important to me about this study and why I really wanted to get this program on WNIN and get it done in a meaningful way, is because finally we can prove that, yes, the assertions are true, or what you've heard, the conventional wisdom, is not true. We can say one way or the other, and we've got facts to back it up. And that's what's really important to me about this.
I believe that one of the things that, and we have talked about this before, one of the things that is most shocking is how mixed race families in the future are going to become more, and as they increase in the general population, and that becomes a trend, that's also going to affect their wealth as a family. It's not, I guess it's not part, it's not hard, hard facts, but I definitely believe that that projection that was given from Emmons to the rest of the world was a very controversial assertion, you know, that he made. And when Sam and I were interviewing some of the people, and we kind of mentioned that, you know, they were very shocked about that. And most of them didn't believe that, that that's what's going to happen in the future. I don't know if you remember that, Sam, but that was one of the things that we talked about with the Hispanic family. And they were very clear that they didn't really think that being mixed in a family was going to affect your wealth that much.
Yeah, and I know we also talked with Howard Ross, who's an expert in diversity training, and talked about in the future with everyone becoming more globally connected, that this is something that's going to continue to happen. So if we see the problem now, the question is this something, if it just keeps trending to happen, that it will then become the norm and we won't see these gaps in wealth? Or is this going to be a thing that just widens the gap? So it's right now, I mean, they've shown that what's happening currently, but I think that's something they're going to have to keep studying in the future to see if that actually makes a difference and if people are becoming more accepting or if it's going to like still be an issue.
The projection that you mentioned that William Emmons made, that the increasing number of mixed race families, of blended families, is going to tend to keep incomes low, just hit me very close to home. I'm of another generation than you two. It stirs up images of the Ku Klux Klan, of white supremacy. Those are the arguments that those folks would have made for keeping the races separate. So when you say, make a statement like that in America, that is, I would go past controversial and call it a provocative statement, that our system is set up in such a way that you cannot marry the person you love and still be successful in America. If that's true, then we probably do need to change.
I think also we touch on the part with the education attainment, dealing with how much student loans now cost people to be able to achieve higher education levels. So we had Susan Montalvo Gesser. Mm-hmm. She spoke on the Owensboro panel, and she didn't win the lottery in her race. She didn't win the lottery in her, I guess,
in her age.
Age, yeah.
She was born in 1975. she missed that one completely.
Yeah. So she worked hard though to get the educational attainment, but is now paying a price for it. And with us constantly hearing about student loans increasing all the time, the question is, how will that impact younger generations' financial wealth in the future? Because pretty much it's now setting up a not optimistic look at going and getting a higher education, because it's going to hurt you later on, and you're going to spend more time paying that off instead of accumulating wealth for retirement.
I think one of the things that we had talked about also before, going along those lines, was that college education now, as you said, is so high, you know, you have to pay so much for it. And so people are opting for doing apprenticeships. And I have noticed that that has become, as a college student, I have noticed that that has become more and more common. I know many people who prefer to just do a four-year apprenticeship with a company instead of going 4 to 6 years to college and getting a bachelor's degree.
And are we creating a second class of citizens by saddling the younger people with the debt? And it's important in this survey is that that was not part of Emmons' original essays, and the St. Louis Fed Research original essays, but they added it, and they are continuing to look at that, and they will have some definitive information about the effect of student loan debt in the future. They said because the outcry was so great because everyone who was younger brought it up. They said, oh my gosh, you can't not talk about student loan debt when you talk about our generation.
And that's one of the things I think that I became interested in after reading the surveys of stuff that I think would be interesting to look further into. I know one of the other things we had looked into, Paola, was the payday loans and the interest in that and how that's impacting people's financial wealth too, because people will try to get that early paycheck and then they're just hurting themselves then eventually because they keep getting it. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit on that.
Yeah, one of the things that we looked into was we watched a couple of videos on the subject, and I remember we looked up articles trying to understand why people were being arrested for not paying back, I guess, their payday loans. And it's just like a cycle. You know, you get a loan, then after a little bit, the interest is so high and you can't pay it. So you go to jail or you get arrested and you have court fees and you have jail fees and you just keep accumulating this big debt that you can probably never pay. And I think that's one of the most interesting things of the study, even though it doesn't really touch on it directly. But that was one of the things that we definitely looked into, and I think we should look into a little bit more.
Because I think it tied into the financial health scorecard overall, and I know that's, we're going to touch on that here in a little bit, but I know it's one of those things that within the questions, that was one of the things that could cause someone's score to not be considered a healthy score. So,
well, in what you just talked about, Paola, in this country is we have had a long held principle that we have eliminated debtors' prisons. You cannot go to jail for what you owe, but in fact, that is it's an uncomfortable truth that is what's happening, because the fines and the court costs and things are becoming so high that people end up going to jail because they can't pay them on judgments against them. And so that's another uncomfortable truth that comes out when we start talking about the demographics of wealth. Yeah, we wanted to talk about the financial scorecard and also some solutions, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I know, I remember when I first read the financial scorecard and I was at first confused myself, and it took me a few times to go through it. And I know, Paola, it took you a few times to go through it as well, kind of understanding it, which your reasoning is different than mine since your first language was Spanish. So, but I think that says a lot, though, is if people have a difficulty in understanding it at first, you're going to have a harder time answering it. And it makes it harder for them to get results back and get accurate results, because people might misread something or misunderstand it. And that can alter their score on the card.
And that's right, Sam. I remember reading the scorecard maybe 10 times in 5 minutes, because I just, and I will go back to a question, and when I finish reading it, I will have to go back again to it. And like you mentioned, my first language is Spanish. So after we sat down and I translated the scorecard, I could understand what they were trying to say, but I had to go word by word, just making sure that I was translating to the right context of the question, because I guess the wording is a little bit heavy for a Spanish speaker specifically, because there's so many things that one word can mean 10 things in Spanish, you know. And after I translated the scorecard, I would say that it was a lot easier to understand. But I'm a Spanish speaker, but I speak English every day, like I was telling you. And that surprised me. I thought that for me it would be a little bit easier. But if I speak English every day, how do you expect to get accurate results with someone who is not exposed to English all the time? And
maybe higher level English.
Yes, yes. And
on a daily basis.
It was definitely challenging. It was, and at a time it was frustrating to read the questions.
We do have these available on the website, both in English and in Spanish, correct?
Yes, we will have them online. Just to catch, I guess, to follow along with what you just said, Paul, my other question almost becomes then, is a generational thing, because I haven't had as much time to grow financially and make some of the bigger financial decisions, that maybe that's why I had a more difficult time with it, is my history with being involved in financial mm-hmm. making decisions isn't so great. And looking at that, that's kind of terrifying to me personally, because going into being in the workforce and being an adult, you don't feel ready, then that's going to start you off at a not so great jumping point to jump into this. You're kind of like diving into the deep end there and just having to make choices that you might not have been ready for. And I know one of the solutions in a community is with the Boys and Girls Club. They offer a financial class for the participants in the program to be able to be a part of and learn about how to like start a bank account, how to invest wisely, helping them be able to be ready for the adult decisions they'll have to make soon on. And it makes you question then, well, is the U.S. doing enough to prepare young children to be ready for that? But yes, we're offering these online. One of our big goals is to kind of create community involvement. We offer them online and you can submit it. And there's no name given, so there's nothing with your identity tied to it. We're just trying to collect it and get an idea of how our community is doing, because there is no data.
So we're talking about the financial health
yes.
scorecards now, so that you can, an individual can go on there and submit that back to us, and we'll take the information. There's no one's name tied to it, and mm-hmm. use that in future programs. Well, one of the things that came out in the workshops and the forums and the public meetings that I attended on this time after time after time is that it doesn't do any good to say that people of lower income need to have financial literacy when they don't have money to start with. And what is clear in the essays is that the people who have money are much more financially literate. Why? Because they need to manage that money. If you don't have it, you're not going to be literate, because there's nothing to be, there's nothing to be literate about.
And Kayum touched on that earlier in our program with talking about how financial literacy might not be the best step to address people who are in the lower income and want to move up. Instead, provide more of an incentives idea to give them a reason why they need to save, a reason why to invest their money a certain way.
Much, much more to talk about. This is going yes. to be a very interesting series. We want to make sure that folks understand that we're not just going to talk about the problems. We're also going to talk about the solutions, and that will be an entire program, in fact, in this series, mm-hmm. about what's being done and what might be done, so that we can hopefully prompt discussion among local government leaders about ways to fix some of these things.
Recreate the American dream is one way to look at it.
Or define it. Define the American dream.
This is The Trend on WNIN FM Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro. The producer of our Demographics of Wealth series is Samantha Horton, with help from me, Paola Marisan, and John Gibson on future segments.
Support for this program is made possible in part by USI Outreach and Engagement, where USI is partnering with 23 counties along I-69, collaborating on economic development. More information at usi.edu/community.